The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order. We're not quite at a quorum yet. We will break in and interrupt our good friend Mr. Cummings to officially convene when we do have a quorum. Whose phone do I have here? That's your phone?
Absolutely.
Mr. Nash, could you give Mr. Cummings his phone back? Thank you. Okay, so as soon as we have a quorum, like I said, we will take care of some of the official business. What we have today is we have House File 2071-2943. These are the department policy and technical bills, and so we will actually technical and policy the way it looks here. We will go over that, but first of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Cummings for the snacks and treats that we have here today. You'll notice there's no rolls or bagels or no whites or ground or refined flour. It's all stuff that we're supposed to be eating, so eat up, folks.
Just like the policy and technical bill, Mr. Chair.
It's good for you. It's good for you. That's right. And Ed, I did check with any type of, you know, as legislators, we have to be very careful on if we give something to somebody or receive something, and we just do not go to jail, because so we have to be very, very careful. So I had it checked out, and it's appropriate where I can give to Mr. Cummings, since he brought such a nice gift here. I'm giving Mr. Cummings a gift for his Atwater Falcons.
Oh, right? All right.
Falcons. So, Mr. Nash, could you please come here and get this for, we want to give this to
well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Falcon from Atwater. Are you actually Grove City or?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I am a native of Grove City.
Ooh, I better watch from Sam. Yep. Watch my tongue.
Yep, absolutely.
Or Cosmos. Yes. Yeah. We've got to be careful here. So, and you're not required to wear it, but you can display it, certainly.
That's Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so with that being said, when we have a quorum, I'll be moving a house. Which one would you like first, in the order on the agenda?
Mr. Chair, the policy bill may be best to, it's a little longer, maybe that should go first.
So we'll when we get going, members, we'll be working off House File 2943. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss the 2016 Department of Revenue's policy and technical bills. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for carrying all of the policy and technical bill provisions once again this year. Mr. Chair, I will be providing some opening remarks, and then our attorneys will be walking through the provisions of the policy and technical bills in the order of the bill and the summary. We do have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair, that we would like to place on the bill. And we can do that later or right now, Mr. Chair.
Well, we'll do that when we have a quorum, but work off it as if it's on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as our attorneys go through the bills, they will talk about them as if it was amended, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The only items changing in the bill are suggestions from legislative staff made when we did an overview a few weeks ago. One of the strategies to achieve the department's vision, Mr. Chair, is that we are listening to our customers to identify and develop improvements to the revenue system. Throughout the year, the Department of Revenue notices items many times after working with our customers in the tax code that could be clarified, updated, or corrected. These ideas are developed, edited, and improved throughout the interim. After development, they are drafted into bills and begin to move through the legislative process. Mr. Chair, if the tax bill is like a meal, there are some meaty provisions or sweet provisions. Then there are the provisions that everyone likes, Mr. Chair, like chocolate cake. The policy and technical bills are more like the fruits and vegetables of every tax bill. These bills make the needed changes to help ensure the tax code is healthy and working properly. They improve the clarity and effectiveness of the tax code. Many people tend to view these provisions in these bills as either being definitely policy, having a substantive impact, or definitely technical, conforming to current practice, or change with no impact. Yet many times it is not black or white. It is usually grayscale, somewhere in between. In preparing these bills, we need to make judgment calls as to which bill is appropriate for each provision. If you would have selected another bill placement, we're certainly open to that discussion of which bill each provision should be in. We prepare two bills rather than one in deference to the legislature's requests in the past.
Mr. Cummings, if you could hold right there. Members, we do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. I will move House File 2943 for layover for possible inclusion. I will now move the H2943A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So now we have the bill in the shape that I want and the department wants. So with that, please continue, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to offer to all of you our assistance to ensure that we have the opportunity to address issues in an appropriate way if they are brought forward today. These are small but important provisions that will make our tax code better. So if issues do arise, we thank you preemptively for the opportunity to work with you, Mr. Chair, and the partners. Mr. Chair, this year is a little different than previous years. Although I seem to be saying that every year now, the Department of Revenue placed a set of policy and technical bill provisions before this committee last year. Those provisions were talked about, and many of those were tentatively agreed to at the end of last year. Throughout last year, we worked with Mr. Lilienquist from the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, Ms. Cadoon from the Chamber, and Ms. Larson from the Business Partnership on updates to selected policy and technical bill provisions. The Department of Revenue stands by our full 2015 policy and technical bill package as updated with the language that we developed in collaboration with our partners. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and your able staff for working with us on those provisions.
And I would thank you. One thing, so we don't forget it for the day, Representative Simonson, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to approve the minutes, but I would also like to amend by making sure that Representative Knobloch gets proper credit for being present at the meeting.
Okay, thank you, Representative Simonson. Members, we're going to amend the minutes to have Jim Knobloch, instead of excused, to have him up there, members present, because he was here. So I will amend that, or we'll make a motion to amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails now. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of March 10th, 2016 as amended. Any discussion? Hearing all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. Okay, item next. So that was, okay, your overview. Now we're going to get into 2943 itself.
So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to our attorneys within our department who will walk through the bills as a resource to this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present these bills today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, and thank you for the buffet. Appreciate it. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jacob Smith, and I'm an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll be walking through Article 1 of House File 2943.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Section 1 changes the date when employers must submit a Form W-2 to the department from February 28th to January 31st. This section is effective for wages paid after December 31st, 2015. By requiring employers to submit W-2s earlier, the department is able to compare what is filed by a taxpayer with what was submitted by their employer. This provision would also put the state in conformity with the IRS, which starting in 2017 will require employers to submit W-2s, W-3s, and 1099 miscellaneous by January 31st, as well as 12 other states have an earlier W-2 deadline. Sections 2, 3, and 8 codify and make slight changes to the requirements to file an annual withholding return. Sections 2 and 3 provide that employers who are required to withhold less than $500 are eligible to file an annual return. Those annual withholding returns are due January 31st. The commissioner is given the authority to determine which employers are eligible to file an annual return and to notify which employers newly qualify to file annually. And it also provides that previous notifications that the department has sent out to employers sent by the commissioner constitute notifications for purposes of allowing employers to file an annual return. Sections 2 and 3 are effective for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2015. Section 8 repeals Minnesota Rule 8092.1400 because it's no longer necessary given the changes in Sections 2 and 3. Section 8 is effective for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2015, except that notifications by the Department of Revenue to employers of eligibility to file an annual return for taxes withheld in calendar year 2016 remain in effect. Sections 4, 5, and 7 make changes to allow S-corporation shareholders and partners to request that assessments be issued to and paid by the entity after the initiation of the audit, rather than the individual shareholders or partners. The changes in these sections would also give the commissioner the authority to determine when such requests should be allowed and that those decisions made by the commissioner are not appealable. These provisions also amend Minnesota Statutes Section 290.31 and 289A.31 to allow partnerships to be liable for the individual income taxes due from partners. And the changes in these sections are effective the day following final enactment. These changes in these sections are in response to requests by taxpayers under audit who have asked for this ability. And finally, Section 6 of Article 1 makes clarifications to the research and development credit. Specifically, it amends Minnesota Statute 290.068, Subdivision 2, to make clear that Minnesota sales or receipts must be used in all calculations of the base period for the research and development credit. And this section is effective the day following final enactment.
Mr. Smith, to that point, why is that needed?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to my colleague, Jeremy Iden, who drafted this provision and can give more clarity.
Okay. Or I'll tell you what, why don't you join us, sir? Do you want to finish? I should have let you finish. Do you want to finish the whole thing, and then we'll go to questions for members?
Mr. Chair, that's the final section of Article 1.
Article 1. Okay, why don't we stop there then? Sir, if you could please come down. And just so we know where we're at here, is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns on my bill? Anybody against my bill? Just checking. Okay, if you could join us, sir. Yeah. Pull up another chair there so we can keep everybody there. So members, so I'll go, if there's no one who wishes to testify, we will go to questions for members. Okay, so on Section 6, why do we need to change anything there?
Mr. Chair, first, my name is Jeremy Iden. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
E-I-D-E-N?
That's correct, sir. Mr. Chair, to your question, in the calculation of the base period, it's clear from the definitions in the Minnesota Research Credit that the aggregate receipts should be Minnesota receipts that are used. A question has come up in the latter part of the Internal Revenue Code provision that talks about aggregate gross receipts. The Minnesota Department of Revenue has always administered this as a Minnesota credit using Minnesota receipts throughout. But aggregate gross receipts, as I've added to the definition, wasn't specifically listed as having to use Minnesota gross receipts. This decreases the base period due to receipts being used throughout the country instead of just in Minnesota.
Okay, one other question, maybe to Mr. Smith, on Section 1, removing W-2s from February 20th to January 31st. Also, you mentioned 1095s. Does that include 1095As?
Mr. Chair, I spoke of 1099 miscellaneous, and that's the federal provision. This change in Section 1 would only require submission by employers to the department from February 28th to January 31st. And so it does not impact 1095.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, too, I think if I understood what you said, on page 6, 6.1, 6.18 and 6.19 eliminates the ability to appeal to tax court or any other court. And you mentioned, I think, during that section that the taxpayers wanted that. Why would taxpayers not want to have the ability to appeal the decision of the commissioner?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the request that the department received related to the ability of shareholders and partners to be able to have the entity, the S corporation or the partnership, pay the liability. As to the specifics relating to the appealability of those orders, I will defer to the author of this provision, John O'Mahony, my colleague.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids. My name is John O'Mahony. I'm a staff attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative, in answer to your question, the language about the decision specifically not being appealable follows the language in the bill that allows a taxpayer to petition for the use of the program in the first place, and that language specifically provides that the taxpayer may petition for the use of an entity level assessment and that the commissioner may allow it when it's in the best interest of the state. And the portion of the decision that's specifically not appealable to the tax court is whether or not it's in the best interest of the state to allow the entity to receive the order of assessment and pay the audit liability. The reasoning behind that is it would create a new tax court level appeal during the audit process. We're worried about that from an administrative perspective. We also think that there's a very small class of claims that we would not allow the use of an entity level assessment for. An example of that would be a small partnership with only resident shareholders where additional income would clearly wipe out some phase out that would disqualify them for credit. In a situation like this, it would clearly be in the state's best revenue interest not to allow them to use the program. That would not be most claims, but that is the reasoning behind that language.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I understand the difference here between the state's best interest, which kind of always carries the club, and those of taxpayers and other shareholders. And when I heard you say that the shareholders and taxpayers and so forth wanted these provisions, it sounds to me it's more like the state wants the ability not to have an appeal instead. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings?
This was something that was requested many times. Some entities are coming in and they're saying, look, we could have all of our shareholders paying a small amount of tax, or the entity could just pick up the bill. And a lot of entities were saying, look, this is just easier for us if we were to just pay it and then we were able to deal with it as we deal with the shareholders rather than billing each shareholder individually.
So, Mr. Cummings, once the decision's been made to allow that, that part's not appealable. So
right.
The entity likes that because they can use different ways to pay that. Okay.
And then there's some finality there, right? So that everyone sort of knows who's got the obligation.
So once the customer has their way, they have their way, and they can't appeal it.
All right. Once there is some finality, yes.
Okay.
Representative
Petersburg. Yeah, that didn't sound right, but if you back it up one step, it makes some sense. Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I actually had a question in that same section you did, Section 1. But the reference to the 1099s was specific to the 1099 miscellaneous. There are other 1099s, and are there going to be changes there required by the IRS, you know, for example, the 1099R, dealing with retirement income, and there are 1099I for interest and what have you. So is it just the 1099 miscellaneous, and why not the others?
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to answer your question, this is a change that the federal government made in one of the more recent tax bills passed by Congress. To answer that specific question, I'd have to get back to you.
Okay, yeah. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I know that in your testimony on the W-2s and the 1099 miscellaneous, you represented or you indicated we'd be in compliance with the feds. And so you're saying that the feds simply didn't include the other 1099s, apparently.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the conformity would be with the date when employers would have to submit that those forms to the department or federally to the IRS. It would both be January 31st.
Representative Carl.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I think we're maybe, I'm not clear. Maybe this is just a yes or no. So other 1099s are not required by the IRS to be out by January 31st, then, just the 1099 miscellaneous.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to get back to you on the specific the specifics of the federal law as it applies to Minnesota.
Okay, maybe, Mr. Chairman, maybe that should be looked at. I'm a bit surprised for whatever reason that they would only pick out one 1099 that has to be out by January 31st and not the others. Just a personal footnote, for example, I mentioned the 1099R. You know, I happen to be a retired teacher. I know there's at least one other retired teacher here. So it's sometimes the 1099s that I'm waiting for more than the W-2 in terms of being able to do my taxes. And there would be all kinds of Minnesotans that would have income from sources that are not necessarily a W-2 or even the 1099 miscellaneous, and that's why I raised the question. But the feds maybe... Well, if you could check and see, maybe somebody can tell you why the others aren't included.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Or maybe they are.
I thought all 1099s were supposed to be January 31st. Mr. Michael, help us out here.
Mr. Chairman, you have to distinguish between the requirement to send it to the taxpayer and to send it to the IRS and the Department of Revenue. There's been a general requirement for W-2s, for example, and for some of the 1099s that the taxpayer get them by January 31st, but then there was not a requirement that it actually be sent to the Department of Revenue or to the IRS until a later date. And one of the concerns has been generally that you get there's been increasing amounts of identity theft and fraud where people who essentially want to falsely claim refunds will get somebody's identification information and will send bogus returns into the IRS and try to claim people's refunds, and they won't have stuff that will match the other things. And so it's very advantageous for the IRS and for the Department of Revenue to have this information at the same time the taxpayer does, so they can cross-check the validity of it. And so that's why Congress was changing that, and that's why the Department of Revenue wants to have its law match what the new federal law is.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions on our Representative Carlson?
Just to clarify, that helps in understanding the reason for it, but being that I'm raising the question about other 1099s, and I'm still not clear if the other 1099s are required or not. The testimony was just 1099 miscellaneous. For wherever they go, is it beyond just the 1099 miscellaneous, or does it include the other 1099s?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'm not positive about the federal law. I believe it does include the 1099Rs because those are pretty much equivalent to a W-2 wage. And they oftentimes have withholding on them. But I, like Mr. Smith, I would have to go back and look at the federal law, too, to see if that was changed as well.
And, Mr. Chairman, I was basing my question on the testimony, which was referenced just the 1099 miscellaneous. And maybe it is broader when one of you takes a look at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Any other questions on Article 1? Let's go to then Article 2. And is there anyone from the audience wish to make comments on Article 2, just to get an idea? Okay, Mr. Cummings, Article 2.
Kyle Gustafson is an attorney in our appeals and legal, and so he'll be going through Article 2.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kyle Gustafson, G-U-S-T-A-F-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a staff attorney with the department, and I will be covering Article 2 with respect to property tax and local aids. Mr. Chair, Section 1 is the section that was removed in the author's amendment. For everyone's ease of reference, I will use the section numbers that were in the printed bill and in the printed summary, but knowing that those will be renumbered going forward. Section 2, dealing with utility and railroad valuation appeals, this amends the statute dealing with those appeals to require a taxpayer to also name the applicable county or counties, where property lies, in addition to the Commissioner of Revenue in those appeals of the Commissioner's ordered or recommended valuation. Now, a taxpayer will not need to individually serve each of those counties in its capacity as a respondent. It will still only need to serve the Commissioner with that appeal. Section 3 and Section 5 go hand in hand. First of all, starting with Section 5, the repealer of an obsolete rule provision dealing with the equalization of utility property. This is a rule that uses outdated sales ratio methodology and is inconsistent with the sales ratio methods and procedures that are used with respect to other types of property. Section 3 of this provision, or of this article, adds in a new section that will require the commissioner to equalize utility property values consistent with other types of locally assessed property in a methodology that's consistent with what's required by the State Board of Equalization. And then Section 4 creates a data lag for the data that's used in calculating county program aid so that the data that will be used is the data that's most recently available on January 1st of the given year in which the aid is calculated. This data lag will be then consistent with the data that is used for calculating aid to cities and towns. And Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Okay, Article 2, Representative Lothar, and I think we'll go to Mr. Keith Carlson, who has some comments or questions or whatever. Okay, Representative Lothar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple of questions. On the Section 2, the provision that the counties be brought into the legal liability. I note that on lines 8.8 to 8.10, it says it's dealing with valuations for which the Commissioner of Revenue has provided the city or county assessor with valuations by order, or for which the commissioner has recommended values to the city or county assessor. And so if the Commissioner of Revenue is really putting forth the recommendations, why should a county assessor be given county and the county be given legal liability in that circumstance?
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what this does is allows the county to get involved in the case dealing with the valuation. What these are appeals, if you think of the property tax system in year one, the assessment year, and then the pay year, these are appeals from the Commissioner's valuation in year one, the assessment year. And what happens is a taxpayer will appeal against the commissioner, and the county is sort of left out of potentially multi-year litigation over that valuation. So it allows the county to come in to have its voice heard in that case, and also to be able to get information and share information as a co-interested co-defendant with the commissioner so that they're able to receive information without risking the attorney-client privilege. And so then when the tax court, if it goes all the way to a decision from the tax court, that the county has been involved up to that point so that there isn't a question down the road of a surprise for the county coming up at that point that there's been an adjustment in the valuation without the county having an opportunity to be involved from day one in that court case.
Mr. Chair.
Or Mr. Cummings?
Whether or not they, whether or not they're co-litigants or not, the county is impacted either way. And so this, as Mr. Gustafson was saying, you know, this just allows the county more access. Whereas, you know, their budget may be impacted. I know that the Association of Minnesota Counties has talked to us in the past about, you know, times in which litigation has impacted county budgets. So this is a way to bring them in.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wasn't sure if this was transferring some of the legal responsibilities of defense and preparing the case and that sort of thing to the county, but it sounds like it's a county option, so I'm comfortable with that. And my last question was on the county aid calculation. You said that this would be a data lag, and is that because you haven't been able to get timely data from the other state agencies that contribute this information? You know, caseloads can vary. A lot of things can vary from year to year just because differing economic circumstances hit different parts of the state. And so if we could just get a little more explanation on the data lag and what its impact might be.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I think what there had been talk, I know that there was some changes that had been made to the LGA formula back in 2013, I believe. And then I know that there had also been talk about the county program aid formula. The department, frankly, held back from really engaging in how that formula should, if there was a modification made to that formula. But the one thing that we knew for sure was, is that many times that the estimates that were given during session related to what county program aid would be like was based on the best information possible. But the time in which all of the abstracts are complete and the information that has been given in order to run the actual county program aid formula is what we get in June. And so when it comes to July and the formulas are finally run and the aid is distributed, frankly, there are surprises for counties. There's surprises for the legislators. I know that I'm not sure if you had been on the receiving end of some phone calls, Chair Davids, but I know some others had been, that there had been differences between the final run and what had been certified. So this is this is not the fix for county program aid going forward into the future, you know, the silver bullet. But this is one tool to ensure that you have a full understanding of what is going on with the county program aid formula and the certifications as you leave session, you'll know. And this is modeling also LGA. LGA does have a data lag like this. So it might be, I know that there are some changes that are going on in valuations. Maybe the effective date could be pulled out a few years, but I think that we think that this is something prudent and needed so that legislators can have some certainty about what the numbers for the CPA distribution are.
And yes, Mr. Cummings, I do get the calls. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think as much as we can, we should be real time whenever it's possible. And so if there's problem solving that needs, I mean, maybe we can't do it on the valuation, I'm not sure, but are there other things that sometimes we've run into problems with, I'll just say, other state agencies not being able to get data timely, and sometimes fixing that is better than always being so out of touch with what's really happening in that economy and the demands on whatever governmental unit it is.
Thank you. We're still on Article 2. Mr. Carlson, if you could join us. And if you could just let me know if anybody else in the audience wants to testify regarding Article 2. If you could just let me know here. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of four of the suburban counties and 10 of the greater Minnesota counties containing regional centers. And my comments are to Section 4. To my knowledge, no county is requesting this change. Certainly neither our organization or the Association of Minnesota Counties are requesting the change. As has been discussed here, this basically delays the contemporaneity of the information used for calculating county program aid. And while making this change would provide that the runs during session reflect what the actual will be, the practical import of this is that it will delay the relief that will be going to many of the high agricultural value counties as a result of we're finally seeing out there that agricultural values are declining. In 2014, some of the veteran members of the committee may remember 11 counties fell off the half of the formula referred to as the tax-based equalization aid portion side of the formula. Due to the action of this legislature, all of those 11 counties were in effect grandfathered in and money appropriated to bring them back to their 2013 level of aid. But valuations that are already lagged by 1 year continue to rise, so that in 2015 we saw 27 counties fall off the tax-based equalization aid of the side of the formula. Obviously, this has caused a lot of angst. There's been a task force of county officials that have worked on recommended formula changes, but in the meantime, we're finally seeing that pattern starting to reverse. And so now many of the heavily ag counties are coming back on the formula. Three counties will come back on the tax-based equalization aid side of the formula if the current data is used based on the preliminary data. But a number of the other ones will see substantial increases if the most contemporaneous data, which is the pay 2015 assessment, were you to follow this language, you'd simply be putting that off for another year. That's where almost all the volatility in the current formula occurs, and I think in counties' opinions, we should let that transition happen as quickly as possible rather than delaying it. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Carlson. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's your estimate that, 25 counties would be still falling off that list at this point?
Mr.
Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, right now, based on the preliminary values, and that's only one category of the data that's been using, we believe that three of the 27 will come back on the formula, and consequently 24 would be off the formula. But again, there are a number of other ones that didn't fall totally off, but that will see significant increases based on the preliminary values, and that would again be delayed if we follow this language.
The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that there's a chance that some other counties may go onto that list while some may fall off. So there is.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I don't foresee, based again on the preliminary data, that any further counties will be falling off. More counties will be coming back on the formula based on the preliminary evaluation data.
General from Lyon. Mr. Carlson, with the Coonan provisions in conference committee, if those were adopted, would that kind of solve this problem or this issue?
Mr. Chair, it would be helpful, but I again have to mention that in the meantime, the county organizations met and came up with a recommendation that would change that formula that would effectively bring all 27 or 24, whether we're talking about the current 27 or the 24 that would remain off, back onto the formula. So that would be the most effective fix. But as you know, the Coonan provision does have additional money attached to it.
But if we work through the Coonan provision, then would we still might need Section 4 as far as from the eyes of the department. They still may want Section 4, even if we do the Coonan language.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The Coonan provision has proposed to be modified by the current formula that has been forwarded by the Association of Minnesota Counties ourselves. would have the result of bringing those counties back on the formula. But the remaining counties that saw an increase, which would include Brown, Dodge, Fillmore, Freeborn, Lyon, Meeker, Maurer, Nicollet, Nobles, and Waseca, would not necessarily see the increase that they would be seeing right now based on the most contemporaneous valuations.
Mr. Carlson, did you say Fillmore?
Yes, I did.
Okay, and not members that we would accept any Senate provisions whatsoever, but just a thought. Okay, Representative Ansells and then Carlson. Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, can I be assured that nothing in Section 4 pertains to or would impact conservation easements, county program aid, and evaluations of privately held property?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anzalk, it does affect county program aid. It does not affect conservation easements. It does not affect the valuations of privately held property.
That's good.
Anzals?
That's very good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carlson and other members that have questions for Mr. Carlson. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I can wait a moment if I'm on. I wanted to get a reaction on Section 2. If there's others on Section 4, I can wait.
Any other questions for members on Section 4? Representative Carlson to Section 2.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this morning when I looked over the brief for the bill, I actually marked that one because in the brief it said that it would require that the counties be sued as part of the litigation with utilities and railroad property, and I was just wondering if Mr. Carlson had a comment about that section. My initial reaction when I read the brief was, well, legal fees. You know, because we do have counties that do have a lot of railroad property, for example, more than the average, and, you know, are we driving more litigation and more costs for the counties as a result of this? This is my basic question, but I'd like to just get your reaction to that section.
Mr. Carlson, do your members want to be sued?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, our members do want to be served, just so that we are on notice that they are contesting those valuations, so at least we know that that valuation is at risk. We intend that the department will still be the primary defender of the valuations that, as has been noted, they are the ones who actually come up with. But if there's enough risk, then at least we could also file a response to that suit in addition to the state. But basically, the notice is what we're looking for, and we would be agreeable with the provision.
Okay, Carlson.
That was what I was wondering, if they were agreeable, and he just said they were. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
What Mr. Carlson said is our intention.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to go right back to that because it seems to me that this is a little bit contradictory language, and I'm hoping you can clarify for this. It says that the commissioner and the county or taxing district shall be part of the appeal, but then it goes on further in 8.12, that service must be made to the commissioner only and not to the counties. And so how do you serve the appeal to the county, I mean to the commissioners, but make the taxing district and county part of it without giving them also service of notice? So how does that work? And maybe you can clarify that. Maybe it's just a language issue.
Mr. Gustafson or
Mr. Chair, Representative, how this would be done is that the taxpayer would only have to file or to serve the commissioner, and then the commissioner in turn would relay that to the counties, and the commissioner would handle that responsibility of actually getting service to the counties to put them on notice.
Representative Petersburg?
And where does that mandatory notification in statute indicate?
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it doesn't.
I mean, I think that's
Petersburg.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. That to me just does seem like it's a little bit ambiguous, and so we may want to work on that or correct that in the future as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petersburg. Article 3 members' questions. Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Let's go to Article 3. And members, as we speak in about 2 minutes, the governor is presenting his budget proposal. And so just so members know, I just want to announce that I'll be carrying the governor's budget proposal. We will have a hearing. I would like to lock it down into next week, but we're not sure because we don't know if we'll have the actual bill before us at that point. So the governor is releasing his budget proposals in about 2 minutes here, and so we'll be very interested to see what the governor's proposing. And as I said, as soon as we have a bill, Representative Earhart?
As chairman, are we going to take a break? Is that what you said?
No. We'll have to wait for the excitement.
I didn't think it was that important.
Yeah, it's but just we will. I will be very interested to get the spreadsheets, and I'm sure members, just to let you know that, and I'm sure you were well aware that he's doing that in a couple minutes here. So
I did have a question though,
Representative Earhart.
I was wondering, is this going to apply by itself, or are we going to put it this 2943 and the other bill that the department is? You have it some plans for it, or is it going to roll along as its own entity, or is it going to go somewhere?
Representative Earhart, I do have plans for it. No, what we're looking at, and that's a very good question. That'll probably be the question on every bill we have in tax me this year. The technical and policy bills that were passed in 2015 are sitting in conference committee. So we have heard policy and technical bills through the process and on the floor passed in the conference committee. So we will see, and these are probably some of the less, well, there's really not a whole lot of controversy in the ones that are passed in 2015 out of this body and off the House floor. So we'll be seeing if there's some merging that can be done since we have had technical policy bills passed. But I want to work with both sides of the aisle to see how we get that done. So it hasn't been determined at this point exactly how that's going to work, but we do want to abide by House rules and move forward that way. So, but these are, we've got a lot of provisions we passed last year, and we've got maybe, what, a dozen or so new provisions we're looking at here that would help the department out. Okay, so with that being said, Article 3, please. Mr. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Jacob Smith, and I'll be walking through Article 3. Section 1 of Article 3 amends Minnesota Statute Section 289A.18 to require partnerships like corporations file their tax returns on the same day that the equivalent federal return is due. This section is effective the day following final enactment. Section 2 amends Minnesota Statute Section 289A.37 Subdivision 2 to define what constitutes an erroneous refund. It further clarifies that assessments of tax that do not involve an erroneous refund are generally conducted under Minnesota Statute Section 289A.38. Under this section, an erroneous refund does not include any amount paid pursuant to a claim for refund of an overpayment of tax filed by a taxpayer or a refund or credit paid pursuant to a claim for refund for a credit or tax relief program, so long as the amount paid does not exceed the amount claimed by the taxpayer. An erroneous refund occurs when the commissioner issues a payment to a person that exceeds the amount the person is entitled to receive under law. This provision codifies the department's previous administrative position that it has held since 1987, when the erroneous refund statute of limitations was first enacted. This section is effective the day following final enactment and applies retroactively to all refunds issued on, before, or after the date that date, other than the refunds at issue in Connexus Energy v. Commissioner of Revenue, the Minnesota Supreme Court case, which was decided in August of 2015. The changes do not invalidate any assessment made by the commissioner prior to the effective date.
Is there anyone from the audience? Thank you, Mr. Smith. Anyone from the audience wish to make comments or have any questions on Article 3? Any questions from members? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Cummings. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith, O'Mahony, Iden, and Gustafson. Thank you very much. Okay, as the bill as a whole here, any other questions?
Mr. Chair, we'll be moving Cummings. From the fruit, Mr. Chair, to the vegetables, to our technical bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So what I will do, members, is I will move that House File 2943 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a possible omnibus tax bill, maybe. Okay. With that being said, I will move my House File 2871, and there's an amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the order the author would like. Mr. Cummings, can you please tell me what my bill does?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Mr. John O'Mahony, an attorney with the Department of Revenue.
Welcome. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids. My name is John O'Mahony. I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be walking through the department's 2016 technical bill.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1 of the 2016 technical bill involves homesteads of blind and disabled Minnesotans. This provision clarifies that property with a value in excess of $50,000 is classified as 2A property for these residents to the extent that the property does exceed $50,000 in value. It was clear in the previous law that the rate for 2A property did apply to that portion, but it was not stated specifically in the law that the classification itself applied. Section 2 of the department's technical bill involves allocation language under Minnesota Statute 290.17, Subdivision 2C. This is specifically a one-word change to the third unnumbered paragraph underneath Subdivision 2C. It changes the word assignable to allocable. This is consistent with the department's more modern interpretation of the meaning of those words. It is not a substantive change, and the department's form instructions and method for administering this paragraph will remain consistent after the change. Section 3 deals with the calculation of estate tax and specifically provides that Minnesota estates are entitled to subtract the value of property that is subject to a Minnesota-only Q-tip election from their taxable estate before applying the applicable rate and calculating the tax. It is my belief that the A1 amendment is a corollary to this provision in that it also applies to Section 291.016, though it is, I believe, the second subdivision and not the third. And it, for additions, clarifies that property need not have been deducted from the federal estate in order to be subject to an addition, and that's specific to gifts made within 3 years of death. The gifts that we're talking about here are not technically deducted from the federal estate because they're not included in the first place. So this is just a clarification that those additions are still necessary. Section 4, also dealing with estate tax, is a modification to the language providing for the small business property subtraction. There are criteria for this subtraction that say that an estate cannot include the value of cash, cash equivalents, publicly traded securities, and also assets that are not actively used in a trade or business. The way that the sentence is structured right now, we have had some questions. There's a last antecedent problem. That's what it's called in the grammar books, I believe. So people have asked if they can include the value of cash, cash equivalents, or publicly traded securities if they are actively used in a trade or business. That is not the intent of the provision, and so we are breaking that list down into Romanets to clarify that that last antecedent about being involved in a trade or business is specific to assets. Section 5 is a change dealing with sales tax, and it clarifies that large and ponderous machinery and equipment will not be considered personal property for the purposes of the sales tax. This clarification means that business production equipment, however installed and of whatever size, will not be considered personal property for the purposes of the tax. This is consistent with the commissioner's acquiescence to the tax court's decision in Dames versus Commissioner, which was issued April 7th of 2015, tax court docket number 8228-R. That concludes the 2016 technical bill.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the audience that cares about this? Or, I mean, has any interest in discussing this bill further? Questions for members? Okay, with that, I will move that House 5. Thank you, by the way. That was stem winding. It was very. I did appreciate Representative Erickson, the construction of the sentences there. That was good. Very good. Any questions, comments, or members on this? My bill is amended. I will move House File 2871 as amended, be later for possible inclusion in a possible omnibus tax bill. With that, okay, members, we meet tomorrow. We meet tomorrow at our regular time. We do not meet Thursday. If you didn't get the email, we did cancel Thursday. And like I said, we'll be actively anticipating the governor's budget proposals, and we will give that a full hearing. Anything else from members for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Cummings, you I hope you wear that with pride, being a Cosmos, Atwater, Grove City Falcon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr.
Go Falcons. And thank you for the treats and snacks. They look delicious. I'm going to take some.
Good.
Can I have some?
Yes.
I'll pay for them.
No.
Oh, okay.
Already did,
I just, I'm not registered lobbyist, so I could actually buy you a new car if I wanted to. You're not registered lobbyist either?
I got
yeah. F-150? Oh, okay. Okay, with that, members, good government all the time. We are adjourned.